There's a red light.
Okay, we're in lesson four. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 3, where we read, Matthew chapter 5, verse 3, all the chairs are taken. I've already set out a few extra. I've set out some already, James. Where blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, we talked about in the first lesson that Jesus came proclaiming the gospel of this kingdom. And from the content of that message, we'll see what the character of its citizens should be. The second lesson we looked at was the end of the lesson, and we called it the importance. And I called it that reason because it had to do with obedience to this message. And we talked about it being entrance into the kingdom, where somebody can go into the kingdom because he who does the will of the Father, and everybody who hears these words and acts upon them, these are the people who will enter the kingdom of heaven. So indeed, it is important. Now, this lesson I had Wednesday night kind of got to the end and didn't quite get to the end, if y'all know what I'm saying. I had to kind of rush it in. And I called it the purpose of the sermon, and I probably, in retrospect, I should explain that a little bit better. In 2 points, in application, especially the first point, and also in understanding the message of this sermon as well. First of all, we're to be salt of the earth and light of the world. We're to be different from the world. People should see us serving the Master in that respect, that we are not to be like the world in whatsoever. Distinct was the word. And this is an extension of what we talked about in the prior lesson about obedience. The second point was that Jesus did not come to abolish the law. Now, I didn't have much time to set all this. The reason Jesus had to say this is we look at in Matthew, you know, he just appointed the apostles and he's coming out and he's preaching the Sermon on the Mount. Chronologically, it looks like he's just beginning. What's his point to say in this? But if we match it up with the rest of the, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and all these together, the Synoptic Gospel, especially Matthew, Mark, Luke, Jesus has already been approached by the Pharisees about him healing on the Sabbath. And they're saying he's breaking the law, basically. And also, in Mark chapter 3, they're already planning on killing him. Okay? At this point where he's preaching the sermon, if this matches up with what generally people include when they go by Luke as far as the chronology of the New Testament and the Gospels, I should say. So Jesus is at this point. So he expresses himself in this way where he says, you know, the second point of last week's sermon, that Jesus did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And that part about fulfilling it is a big thing. He also said that the law would not pass away until all is accomplished. Who is going to be the one fulfilling this law? I asked that question. Now I'll ask that question. Who fulfills this law?
Christ.
He says he's going to be the one. That makes him the what?
Messiah.
The Messiah. That makes him the Christ, the Messiah, the King, the Anointed, everything that goes with that. Because of that, he's going to say things within that sermon, within the Sermon on the Mount. He's going to talk about the old law. You've heard said, but I say unto you. This is going to be very important in our understanding. And it brings us to the third lesson, the third part of our last week's lesson, where he talked about they must have surpassing righteousness, that above the Pharisees. The Pharisees took these things of the old law, misapplied them, and so our righteousness, the Jews' righteousness of that day, the people that saw these Pharisees and held them in high esteem, their righteousness must exceed that of the Pharisees, the scribes and the Pharisees. This was quite a major thing to them. But the point is, they misused things of the Old Testament, so we tie these 2 points together, and we'll see how Christ, the Messiah, can... the only chair right now is that one right there, or... Yeah, there's some... Okay. Oh, right by your mother. That'll work out good. And the point being that he's the one who can tell us about these things, and he's going to expose some misapplications that the Pharisees had concerning the law. And we'll see that proper application of the kingdom of the gospel and its message is to the heart of man. We asked that question, and it was answered that they wanted to wash the outside of the cup, but not the inside. Jesus said that of them in Matthew 23, verse 28. Okay, so that was their problem. So we have to work within ourselves as far as looking at the inside of the cup, and then express that toward that, our outside and toward others as well. Now, let's look at Matthew chapter 5, verse 3, or lesson 4, if you're not at lesson 4. In Matthew 5, 3, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. In your lesson, first it says, we call these the Beatitudes. We're finally getting into the point of the sermon, what is called, the Sermon of the Mount. We're at the very beginning, and this word is used, Beatitudes. Beatitudes is not found in the Bible in any way. You see the first definition, I got some definition here, is it is a Latin word, meaning happy or blessed. Okay? And if you've got the NIV version, it says happy. Has anybody else got a different version that might say happy? I think you use the New English. Does it say, you're not using that? Okay. Okay, you're a New American Standard? Okay. But anyway, I was just interested in that one. But anyway, this idea of happy. There was a president we had by the name of Thomas Jefferson, fourth president. He wrote something we all recognize. He wrote that all having, as far as us citizens of the United States of America, we have certain inalienable rights granted to us by our Creator, quote, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I am thankful to be American. I am thankful to live in this great country. And that is a noble pursuit, to be able to pursue happiness in our lives. But what we see when we look about in the world, we see people who perceive it by ways of sin, by ways of indulging in fleshly desires, and by selfishness, and all these different aspects and everything. And then, often, if you're like me, you've talked to some of your friends and you hear this excuse, but doesn't God want me to be happy? Who's heard that in talking to people? Okay? You know what? God does want us to be happy. He really does. He wants us to be content and satisfied, and He wants us to be blessed. And He wants to bless us. And in that, we as Christians will find joy. I'm sad when I see Christians who don't have joy in their heart. And I'm not talking about when you're going through the trials of life and we go through them. But I'm talking about in just an everyday aspect of life that people can't see that we're something that they should want to be. Okay, so consider that. But anyway, getting to this word, the second definition, happy in respects to that, if we can see it brings out the joy, I have no problem with that definition. But I believe blessed is a better definition. This is a quotation from this commentary, Matthew, by Chumley. And I thought I marked it, but that's my thinking. That's my thinking level. Okay. Matthew 5, 3, and he talks about this word blessed. The Greek, and it's the same thing that you got written here, Makarios, blessed is difficult to translate. In Homer's Greek, it described the happiness of the immortals on Mount Olympus, and several versions translate the word happy. While this brings out the joy conveyed by Jesus' word, there's more to blessedness than happiness. In the world, the basis for happiness is happenings, and we'll talk about that in a second. But the kingdom, notice, it is a right relationship with God. In Psalms 33, verse 12, and I've already got this, for time's sake, if y'all don't mind, I'm just going to read it. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom He has chosen for His inheritance. There are what is called 100 blesseds in the Bible. Just so happens by those who use the King James anyway. And by my books that show all the words. Exactly 100 blesseds. So some use these words, 100 Beatitudes, if you'll allow me to use that. But here, what is the blessing here? Which each one of these Beatitudes, there's going to be saying something said with a blessing behind it. Here, the blessing is, whose God is the Lord. We can have assurance in God. And that's our joy. That's our blessedness. And that's what he said here in this commentary, I believe. Secular happiness is an emotional contingent on circumstances. Christian blessedness is rooted in character. And I believe that explains it best. And also something else I found out about this word happy. This first part of the word, hap, has to do with where we get our word or our thought behind it, good luck. So it's contingent on chance happiness. Happenings again, as we talk about everything. The things that happen to you in life. A little kid's happy because the sun's out, he can run outside and play. You know, as opposed to maybe it was raining the day before. Now, nowadays, kids probably rather be inside and play their video games. I don't know that that much matters. But to us as young people, I think most of us can understand that. Sure. But, yes, sir. Go ahead, Rocky.
Back in Psalms 33:12.
Yes, sir.
You addressed the first part of the verse. And you have the second part of it, which, parallelism.
Exactly.
It helps us to understand. So, first we have the nation, and then we have people, part. Parallelism, and it says whom he has chosen for his own inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at the word blessed, at least how it's being used here, and look at it here, how it's used in the Sermon on the Mount. So if God is our Lord,
mm-hmm.
what is the result of that?
Exactly.
We have his own inheritance.
The second line.
We have his own inheritance. If we have God's own inheritance, how does that describe our state?
Mm-hmm.
And I like to look at it, think about it as prosperity.
Exactly.
Whoever in God's position, whether it was the nation of Israel physically or us spiritually, we're going to be very prosperous for his own
inheritance. Yes, sir.
So when I look at the word blessedness, and especially how it's used in Matthew chapter 5, I kind of equate in my own mind another definition. And it's, it has to do with happiness, but it's more of spiritually prosperous. So when we talk about these Beatitudes, these are things that we receive. Be spiritually prosperous by this type of character we have. And so that's just how I kind of look at the word blessed. It's it is a happiness, but maybe a little bit more deeper than that.
That's exactly
right. It's a prosperity that God gives us by being this type of
person. Yeah. Well, that was exactly what I was fixing to say. This idea of blessed is the joy found upon the bedrock, I've got this written here, upon God's favor that remains constant because God remains constant. We talked about happy. The word hap has to do with chance, happenings. But blessed is based on, as Rocky said, that we're citizens of that kingdom, that we're going to receive an inheritance, that we are spiritually prosperous. All these things that we have because we are Christians, because we are citizens of the kingdom. Now, I do believe in that we're to have joy, okay? When we get to the very last one, you're supposed to have joy, and we're going to see that people had joy when they were persecuted, okay? And it's because of exactly what Rocky said, because we're spiritually prosperous. We know that we're people that are blessed. And that's one of the best things we can do to be a light in the world. Is to be spiritually prosperous and be seen as spiritually prosperous. The blessed giver is Jesus Christ, but you're going to have to be warned. The things he says here are shocking. I mean, we read this thing, and it's a little paradoxical to us. We read it, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Poor in spirit? Well, that's not really a very good thing. And we think of poor. I mean, this is that poor guy, our third definition here about poor. Somebody who works for his daily existence, this is really a poor guy. But it's more than that, okay? I've got three words here. It's the third word. The word in Matthew 5:3 is P-T-O-C-H-O-S, the root word, which is derived from, which means to crouch. This is the idea of somebody who crouches down, who begs down, who gets down low. And where am I at here? And this has to do with extremely poor, crouched when they begged. Luke 16, verse 3, and my wife asked, why did you put that in there? Okay, and you probably wondered, why did he put that in there? Because it goes to where I'm going next. It just simply has the word beg. And it's talking about the unrighteous steward. The manager said to himself, "What shall I say, or what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg." Now he's fixing to have everything taken from him. And now he's going to have to beg. And he's going to have to do this third beg thing, because he's going to have nothing. Okay? And he's never worked for a living. So, but the point here is, this includes our word, okay, when I'm talking about begging, this thought of begging. But it brings me to my next point. We don't see that as a blessing, do we? Begging. We don't consider that a blessing. How in the world, the blessed are the poor in spirit. Now this hit them, it hits us, you know, we hear like, hey, maybe like a ton of bricks. But it hit those Jews like a lightning bolt when they first heard this, because they heard this word. We might hear poor in spirit. Oh, well, that's not good. It's the opposite of rich. No, it's more than that. It's crouching down. It's getting low. And it is begging, because you have nothing whatsoever. Look at, and I've got some verses here, Matthew chapter 16. Yes.
And a lot of people don't think that somebody poor could inherit something good.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the whole point. In the end, you're exactly right. In the end. And it's a paradox. Something that you first hear it and you go, well, that just doesn't seem right. But in the end, it's true. And it's in the end, it's true, because we're people of faith. And that's why this statement is true. And we have to believe that. Thank you. Luke chapter 16 again, verses 19 through 21. Now there was a rich man, and he habitually dressed in purple and fine linen, joyously living in splendor every day. And the poor man named Lazarus was laid at the gate, covered with sores, verse 21, and longed to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Besides, even the dogs were coming and licking his sores. Now that's quite a picture. And that's our word. Okay? And that's the word for poor that we're using here. Look at Matthew chapter 15. And this is probably a better illustration of it, but a different aspect of our word. Matthew chapter 15, verse 21. Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And a Canaanite woman from that region came out and began to cry out, saying, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." And he did not answer her word. Answer her a word. And his disciples came and imploring him, say, "Send her away, because she keeps shouting at us." Let's see, 21 through 28. But he answered and said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." But she came and began to bow down before him and saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered and said, "It is not good to take away the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she said, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fell from their master's table." And Jesus said to her, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish." And her daughter was healed at once. You know, first of all, he took the picture of Lazarus. Here was a man with sores and all these things and everything, and he was begging and wished to be fed from even the crumbs that fell at the rich man's table. And that's a picture of what we should be, in a sense, towards God.
I always kind of thought that poor in spirit meant like the opposite of haughtiness.
It does. It does. But haughty before God is poor. But that's what I'm saying. The word itself, poor, means even more. It's even a stronger word than what we use for poor. So this is an approach we have to take toward God, is my point. Yes, sir.
You know, meaning of poor in spirit to those people at that time was something that was not good.
Okay. Exactly.
That's not always the case, the way it was. You know, Jesus was trying to get them to repent and turn back.
Exactly.
Okay, back in Psalms, it describes the poor in spirit as contrite in heart.
Exactly.
We're getting there. Well, I think Psalms 34, Isaiah 51. We're going to use those words, Psalms contrite.
Yeah.
We're gonna. If we get there, we're gonna get there. And with
that's,
me,
that's what I put down. Psalm 51:7. That the contrite heart and the and the broken spirit.
Right, right.
Yes.
Yeah, y'all can. Just give me till point four. We'll get there.
It was something that was not necessarily new to the scriptures or the text of the Bible.
Right.
It was new to them at that time because they had twisted things so much.
Exactly.
Looking
but
for something totally different.
The people in those days, in the Old Testament days, didn't understand it either.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nothing new. And I say, of course, they were still under the Old Testament in the days of Jesus. But I'm talking about in the days of the Psalms, in the days when Isaiah used these words. It's never been different. And that's why we're going to get to the point that only a few will be saved. The straight and the narrow. Because this is such a hard path to follow. And it's always been. And it's, you know, it's exactly his point.
Well, John, there your lesson there about the rich man and Lazarus. Lazarus was not in Abraham's bosom because he was poor and begged. He was there because he had the heart that followed Moses and the law. And the rich man wasn't in Hades because he was rich. It was because he didn't follow the law of Moses. And even when he said his brothers, you know, go back and tell them, he says, they have Moses and the law. So, and the prophets. And so, you know, the reason that Jesus is talking there, he says, it's not because one's rich and one's poor, it's because of their heart towards God.
Exactly. And that's what Jesus is speaking to in this whole sermon. He's going to be talking towards our hearts. That is the beginning. And that's what we're looking for in this whole thing. And that's why it's a spiritual kingdom. And these Jews messed the whole thing. They were looking for, indeed, a literal kingdom. And it's hard for us as, you know, proud Americans to think that we might have to stoop and beg. But this is what we got to do before God. I had point B of number two. Did I have Luke 16 again there?
Yeah.
That should have been Luke 18, and I'm sorry for that. Luke 18, verses 9 through 14. And like I say, this is me doing the typing. I plan on having a lot more of these because I know myself, if that makes any sense. Verse 9, the Pharisee and the publican. And he also told the parable to some people who trusted themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. That's very important right there. Two men went into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. And the Pharisee stood and was praying to himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like the tax collector. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing some distance away, was even unwilling to lift up his eyes to heaven, but was beating his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went to his house justified rather than the other, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Now we see here the way we should approach God. The way we should approach God, the way they should approach God. This is an example. Yeah, Jesus is saying everything here we know to a Jewish audience. We could have backed up. He was speaking to his disciples. But he looked about and he seen these other people. He seen the audience there as well. But he's also, when he says these things in the scriptures, he's speaking to us today. Everything is written here is for today. How do we approach God? Do we go up to, I grew up in the 60s and 70s when things started changing and there were people even calling God Dad and stuff like that, and some of y'all remember that silliness and everything. But over time, have we become lax in the way that we approach God? Do we forget who He is and where we are, where we came from, where we still are? And these are lessons for us, and I believe these are, as I've got here, poverty and spirit is seen best in these two stories. And I'm sorry for having put that wrong verse in there. But go to Luke chapter 7, unless somebody had, I thought I might have seen a hand up. Luke chapter 7.
I actually, the prodigal son is not a bad example of one with a contrite heart. He says, "Father, I've sinned against heaven in your sight, and I'm no longer worthy to call your son. Make me one of your hired men." That's over in Luke 15. Yours was 16, wasn't it?
Yeah, I haven't got to 15 yet.
Okay, all right.
That's point. That's
okay.
Part.
Is that down there?
That's the next point. Yeah.
Sorry about
we're in
that.
Luke 7.
Looking at the wrong place.
That's okay. We save that thought.
Okay.
We'll get there. Verse 36. And I think I got this one right. Okay. Now one of the Pharisees was requesting him to dine with him, and he entered in the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. And there was a woman in the city who was a sinner, and when she learned that he was reclined at the table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster vial of perfume, and standing before him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet in his tears, and kept wiping them with her hair and her head, and kissing his feet, and anointing them with perfume. Now the Pharisee who had invited her saw this, and he said, notice, to himself. That'll help you understand this. If this man were a prophet, he would know who was what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, and that she is a sinner. You gotta love Jesus. Telling this to himself. Now what does Jesus do? He talks right to him about what he just told himself. And Jesus answered him. Isn't that amazing? Simon, I have something to say to you. He replied and said, "Teacher, a money lender had two debtors. One owed him 500 denarii, the other 50. And when they were under repay, he graciously forgave them both. So which of them will he love more?" Simon answered and said, "I suppose one whom he forgave more." And he answered him, "You have judged correctly." Turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. She gave me no kiss, but she, since the time I came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she anointed my feet with perfume. For this reason I say to you, her sins, which are many, have been forgiven. For she loved much, but he who is forgiven little, loves little. Then he said to her, your sins have been forgiven. Those who were reclining at the table with him began to say to themselves, who is this man who even forgives her sins? And he said to this woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Now we see here this example of this woman and what she was. I haven't even got to the point of my lesson. And she recognized her wretched state. In one sense, we talked about sins last week or Wednesday. There are a way we use sins, and we say she had greater sins. Okay? But in another sense, there are no greater sins. Okay? I might have more sins. We might say my sins are worse. But for before God, what's going to cause us to have death? What's going to separate us? Sin. So if we don't recognize this, and that's what Simon failed to recognize. Yes, Jesus' response said her sins were many. Okay? Maybe in response that either Simon's thought, one or the other, maybe his weren't as many, or just, I'm reading your mind and you're saying that. I don't know which one. But that doesn't matter. The problem is, we are all sinners and fall short of the glory of God. Sin is going to bring about death. Ezekiel 18, verse 20 lets us know that. It's a separation from God. We're all separated from God in that respect. And if we don't humble ourselves as this woman did, if we consider ourselves an equal and recline at the table as Simon probably felt, or maybe thought he was better. He was a Pharisee. He may have thought he's better than Jesus. He may have just invited him just as an afterthought, just as maybe another way that they could trick Jesus. I don't know. He may have been sincere. But all these things he didn't do for Jesus, this woman did. And this is the way we need to consider ourselves when we approach Jesus. Do we beg for these things? Do we recognize our state? And this is the first step in salvation. This is the first step Jesus takes. And this next point I got here, or excuse me, the point I should have read at the beginning, it says this is the root beatitude. This is the beginning of it. James is here. Point C. Military boot camp brings an individual down, then breaks an individual down, then belts him back up. Consider this in light of Luke chapter 15. Let's go ahead and go there. Luke chapter 15, verses 18 through 19. And this, of course, is the prodigal son. He's hit rock bottom, and then, you know, he's left his house. He took his father's inheritance, which is the same as saying, "Father, you're dead to me." Okay. In verse 18, he says, "I will get up and go to my father, and will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven in your sight. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men.'" And here was a guy who was broke all the way down to rock bottom. And he reached this level, and he's seen, "I need to go to my father." This goes on and tells a beautiful story of forgiveness. And this is what we have in Jesus Christ. And this is, as citizens of his kingdom, we shall inherit a blessing of the kingdom of heaven. You see, and the Lord's army is just in the same way. You know, this is what Jesus is telling us. Here's how he's starting his message on the Sermon of the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit. This is no accident that this was put here first. By no means. I believe verses 3 through 6, he's going to follow a progression in the Sermon on the Mount. Okay? And we'll talk about that as we get to each one. But when we consider other people in the Bible, God done this to them, or at least they recognize their state. We think of Abraham. He told him to get up and go. He left everything he had and went on the road and followed God. He did what God told him. Had some heartaches along the way, but he's the father of faith in that respect. Moses, he had wealth. He had all these things. He even killed a man and thought that they would follow him. But anyway, he leaves. He's scared. He leaves. And then he's a shepherd on the side of a mountain, or sees a mountain, sees a fire. And he goes to investigate. And he has all these excuses. And yet he is one of the great men of faith in the Bible. We've got Peter. First time he meets Peter, Peter says, "Lord, get away from me. I'm a sinful man." He recognized that from the beginning. But in Peter's way, Peter's just as much that "I'm a sinful man." He's this man of, "But no, Lord, that's not going to happen to you. No, Lord, no. Get away from me, Satan." And then what does Peter do? He sins. But then he cries. He cries some deep tears. He's brought low. And he is a great man of faith. And then we got the example of Paul. One of the greatest men of faith. He's got half the things we're going to read in here are going to be from Paul, because he wrote half of our New Testament, even though we're talking about Jesus Christ and the things he said. In Romans chapter 7, verse 15, we don't have time to read all that. As a matter of fact, we're doing real. Well, let's just look at verse 21. And this just talking about some of the struggles that he had. And we'll read some of this, and then I'm going to just read portions of the verses I've got written down for time's sake. I'm sorry. I'm just long-winded and always make my lessons too long, I guess. Romans chapter 7, verse 21. "I find the principle that evil is present in me, the one who wants to do good." From here we can see the point we want to get. "For I joyfully concur with the law of God in the inner man, but I see a difficult law in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin." This man's got struggles. We see him as such a great man, but don't, you know, just because we don't see his life in the same way we might see some of these Old Testament characters we looked about, and we could talk about David all day and sin, but how he humbled himself and how he prostrated himself before God and got forgiveness. But we're talking about Paul, whose life isn't seen but in his writings. So how we see he has struggles is within his writings, not seeing his life and everything. And we do get quite a bit of Acts, but we get quite a bit more here of these things. Verse 24, wretched man that I am, who will set me free from the death of the body? Notice what he says. Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. And that's who's going to set him free. That's the assurance we have. We got to be like this. We have to recognize that even though we're Christians, even though we began this walk, even though we've taken this first step, even though at one time, you know, we might have been, maybe we remember years back, we were strong for God. Maybe we got first baptized. We were, as some people say, on fire. Have we lost that fire? Paul recognized the state that he was in. We need to not lose that fire. And one way we're not going to lose that fire is to forget that we struggle and to talk to God that we struggle and humbly bow ourselves before Him. And this is how we begin this. Look at the thorn of the flesh, 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I think we've got time for this one. I like the things that go on here. Verse 7, and I don't know what the thorn of the flesh is. The funniest one I ever heard is ball-headed. Since I'm starting to do my comb-over thing, I can relate to that a little bit, but I always thought that was funny. But everybody's got some idea what it is. I'm in 1 Corinthians. Need to quit telling ball-headed jokes. Verse 7, because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself. See that point right there? To keep me from exalting myself, there is given me a thorn in flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment, to keep me from exalting myself. Concerning this, I implore the Lord three times that it might leave me. And he said to me, notice here, he said to me, it's in red writing here, it's interesting, these things that Jesus said, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is perfected in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, I would rather boast about my weakness so that the power of the Lord may dwell in me. Therefore, I am well content with weakness, with insults, with distress. Consider yourself here as we're reading these things. With persecutions, with difficulties, for Christ's sake. For I am weak, then I am strong. Blessed are the poor in spirit. We need to come to this stage right here in life. When we see Paul's example of the things he says, Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20 and 21. We read this, but you know me, like I say, I'm repetitive. Now to him who is abundantly, who is able to do far more abundantly beyond all that we ask, according to the power that works within us. I think we can stop right there. Look at Galatians 2, verse 20. Galatians 2, verse 20. I have been crucified with Christ, and it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. Okay? And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. That's poverty of spirit. When your spirit, in the sense, has allowed Christ to take over your body. Okay? And we don't mean that Christ is living in us, indwelling us, and making us do things. We're talking about when we have become poor in spirit, when we've allowed ourselves, and then we recognize the purpose of Jesus Christ and what we should be doing in our lives, and we give ourselves over Him, and then we're poor in spirit, we have poverty in spirit, we'll be strong in spirit, we'll be spiritually strong. And that's what it's all about. Now, I know I'm confusing everybody. Linda asked what was my fountain. One of my classes I didn't get to the end, which is probably going to be like this one. She asked, well, did we ever figure out what the foundation was in the second lesson? I said, well, it's Christ. She says it's Christ. And I said, yeah, it's Christ, but you can't separate Christ from the Word. Christ is the Word, and Christ is His message. He's the messenger, and His message is that which strengthens us. And when we get to this point, what is the foundation? Notice there I've got spiritual poverty is the foundation for the rest of the sermon. Well, John, you said it was Christ. You said it was message. Yeah, and this is the message, and this is the root of that message. This is the foundation of that message. This is the first step of that message. And that's what it is. We are to be poor in spirit. Okay? Humble is not a big enough word. It's not. We have to be spiritually impoverished because of sin and our recognized state, because He was crucified for us. When we become like Peter, we will be strong in that respect. And we've got to Psalms 34, and I didn't get Psalm 51. I realize what y'all are saying now. Psalm 34, but these will help us. And I'm sorry, I thought I had that one written down, as a matter of fact. Verse 18. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted. Now just, these are going to give you assurance. Every verse we're going to read here. He saves those who are crushed in spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of God. And we'll look at Isaiah chapter 57. And the next three are in Isaiah, so if you would get on over to Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 57, verse 15. For thus says the High and Exalted One, who lives forever, whose name is holy. Now he's going to, in every one of these in Isaiah, we're going to see God exalted. But look who he's going to take care of. I dwell on the high and holy place, and also with the contrite and lowly in spirit, in order to revive the spirit of the lowly and revive the heart of the contrite. And that's, I think you mentioned that word contrite, and that was the, I had that word, and I heard the word rather than the verse, and I'm sorry, I apologize for that. Isaiah 66, verse 2, the last chapter. You know, that's where you need your insurance there in that last chapter, when somebody's writing you a letter, somebody's writing you a book. Verse 2, for my hand made all things, thus all things came into being, declares the Lord. But to this one I will look, to him who is humble and contrite of spirit, who trembles at my word. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And then the beautiful one, Isaiah chapter 40. There was a movie years back called Chariots of Fire. And, you know, being a guy, we like sports movies and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, this is the end of this movie. When he's running, and I don't know if you've seen the movie, he throws his head up and he runs for God. You know, it's a little corny, but it paints a good picture here. Okay? Of course, in the movie, wins. It's awesome. It sent chills up and down my back. Verse 28. And had a lot to do with this verse being read and its timeliness. Do you not know, have you not read, an everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, do not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary, and to him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youths grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait for the Lord, and this doesn't mean wait like, okay, God, catch up with me now. This means wait, that you're relying on Him, that you're allowing Him to lead the way, that He's taking the forefront and you're following Him. Those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. Give me a second to turn my onion page here. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and we'll leave it at that right there. Okay. Any questions, points? All right. Sorry that I didn't quite get through again. We'll be on lesson 5. Maybe we'll bring 4 up to 5 or something. But thank you for all the good things.